Mr. Speaker.
Order, order.
And that's David Carter, the Speaker now for 3.5 years, taking over from his National colleague, Lockwood Smith, on the last day in January 2013. This is Mr. Carter's 8th Parliament. He began as a National backbencher 22 years ago in 1994, when he won the by-election in the Selwyn seat that was created by the resignation of former Finance Minister Ruth Richardson. Mr. Carter has done virtually every job in the House. He's been an electorate MP and a list MP, a junior party whip, select committee member and chairman, and cabinet minister in charge of several portfolios, most notably as Minister for Primary Industries, a position he had prized but had to relinquish to become Speaker. As well as presiding in the chamber, Mr. Carter chairs 4 committees involved in the administration of the House. Among them is the Standing Orders Committee, which, at about this midpoint in every parliamentary term, runs a fine-tooth comb through the rules of debate, procedure and general behaviour known as Standing Orders. We thought it would be a good chance during this adjournment to ask Mr. Carter for a preview of this year's review of the Standing Orders, but got sidetracked right at the start with a question about question time, which Mr. Carter chairs every sitting day whenever he's in the House. It's his most visible role and seldom fails to require his decision on whether a question has been answered or just addressed, a not-so-subtle difference noted by former British Prime Minister David Cameron in his last Prime Minister's question time in the House of Commons on Wednesday, July the 13th.
Order. Questions to the Prime Minister.
I've done a bit of research, Mr. Speaker. I have addressed 5,500 questions from this dispatch box. I'll leave it for others to work out how many I've answered.
There, in a witty nutshell, David Cameron opens the barn door in the middle of Standing Order 386, which says that replies to questions must contain an answer that seeks to address the question asked, if, and this is the final escape, it can be given consistently with the public interest. I asked Mr. Carter if there'd been a shift in emphasis from answering to addressing.
I don't think it's changed at all, and if you rely on speakers ruling right back for 20 or 30 years, the speaker has always said the answer must address the question. Otherwise, the speaker effectively becomes a quizmaster, and very often, in fact, more times than not, the person who asked the question would say it hasn't been answered to my satisfaction. So my technique, I don't think it's changed significantly at all. It is that the question must be addressed. If it's a blatant attempt not to even address the question, then my technique regularly has been to allow additional supplementaries. And the fact I do that, I think, shows that I'm suggesting to the House the Minister's response to date has been totally inadequate.
You mentioned Speaker's rulings. What's the difference between Speaker's rulings and standing orders?
Standing orders are the rules, and Speaker's rulings are the interpretation of the rules by various speakers, and if they're helpful to any future speaker in interpreting standing orders as they exist at that time, then we publish the Speaker's rulings as a guide to speakers. So as questions come into me at 11:30, I'm using my own political experience to think about where supplementary questions might go, and I'm then referring to speakers' rulings as I get ready. Sometimes they go on a different tact, but surprisingly, many times I can predict where supplementary questions are going to go simply because I've spent 22 years or more in the House at question time.
You seem to have a very good memory for the question, and when it comes to an argument as to whether what was asked, is that a really sort of focus that you've developed, or you have a good memory anyway?
No, what I'm doing is I'm writing down as quickly as I can bits of the question so that when a member often says, that was my question hasn't been answered, I've actually asked this, and I say, no, you didn't ask that. You started with, and I certainly get the first part of the question. The questions in my mind, with many of the current members of Parliament, are simply too long as supplementaries. So I could strictly interpret standing orders and rule them out because they're not concise. It is an opportunity for a bit of political debate. It is the debating chamber after all. So I think I'm, as a speaker, relatively lenient in the way I interpret standing order 380, which is that the fact that the question must be concise and without opinion. Many of them actually don't measure that particular rule.
And you would say that your interpretation of that standing order is really no different from Lockwood Smith's?
Oh, it's definitely, in my opinion, it's not. Lockwood used to also attempt to sometimes suggest how a question should be answered. I don't think that's the role of the Speaker at all. The Speaker should not be a judge. He should only judge whether the question has been addressed. If there's no attempt to address the question, fair enough, let the member ask it again. And that, in effect, I think embarrasses the minister often enough to make him cooperate. Sometimes, to be fair, there's quite a lot of noise in the House, and a minister may not have heard the question correctly when it's first given. By allowing it to be repeated, a minister then has an opportunity to clearly hear the question, and I expect the minister then to answer it.
Acoustics play an important part, because you can hear things that we can't hear on the soundtrack.
And there's quite a lot, I think, that members of the public in the gallery can hear, particularly interjections in the back half of the debating chamber, which actually I don't hear. So it's a place where you quite often get quite a lot of heated debate. You get interjection coming from the back half of the chamber. Very hard to hear those specific interjections of what they are, but you certainly know that it's starting to lead to some disorder.
Going back to the standing orders, where we came in, the review of standing orders is about to get underway.
Yep.
And this will be the second time you've chaired the committee.
Correct.
And would you be expecting this to be just a fine-tuning this time, or do you expect any significant changes?
One area that possibly would be worth considering is whether we have the select committee structure appropriate for the way we've formed super ministries. And if you take particularly the Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment, it now spans effectively a whole number of select committees. Is it time to review the title accorded to the select committee? Is it time to review the number of select committees, perhaps have less of them and more members on the select committees? It is a debate we raised briefly at the last review of standing orders. It was not well received at that occasion, but maybe we've moved now to redesign the way we do the financial review debates, for instance, in Parliament, doing them more by topic or theme. Is it time to adjust the composition of select committees accordingly?
And is this something that you bring to the table?
Well, it will be something that the clerk will also bring. I'll bring it to the table. I know the clerk is thinking along those lines. At the moment, what the clerk is trying to do is get more input from those interested in the standing orders so that we do have a good discussion about how to continue to modernise standing orders so they remain relevant. So he has embarked now on a process of going around all the caucuses, trying to get them more involved in what works within standing orders, what doesn't work, what we could change. He's also then going to call for public submissions. They'll be the normal ones that come forward that we've heard before that might not get a lot of traction. But listen, as chair of the committee, I'm open to any ideas that have relevance.
Then, having considered the submissions and all the evidence, you write a report that goes to the chamber and is debated in the chamber, has to be debated by the House?
Yes, it's often a relatively short debate. It depends whether anything's come from that select committee that's absolutely controversial. But over the time that I've been a Member of Parliament, if you go back to the standing orders in 1994 to where they are today in 2016, incrementally they've changed, but when you look at the difference between 1994 and 2016, the changes have been quite significant. Well, one that's worked extremely well are these extended hours, where instead of a government going into urgency time and time again, sometimes for legislation which the public of New Zealand would not have considered to be of an urgent nature, we've now got the opportunity for the government, by consensus of a meeting around the business committee, which occurs every Tuesday that Parliament's sitting in this very office, by consensus they bring legislation that's effectively non-controversial, all parties agree, and they then have the extended sittings, which means on a Tuesday morning or a Wednesday morning or a Thursday morning, the House can sit to cover that sort of business. Particularly treaty settlement legislation has been used a lot in extended sittings.
Your daily routine, when you start work, what do you do first?
I come in about 7 and 7:30, and spend time catching up with emails or correspondence. There's then a number of meetings because I'm effectively the Minister for Parliamentary Service and for the Office of the Clerk. So Parliamentary Service is quite a large organisation employing over 400 people. They are the people in this complex that make the complex work, the security of the Parliament, for example, but also all the electorate staff that are employed by MPs throughout New Zealand are effectively employees of Parliamentary Service. So those two portfolios take a lot of my time through the morning. Another thing that regularly occurs in those morning sessions would be meeting with the various ambassadors. The ambassadors who are either resident here in Wellington, or perhaps if they're smaller countries and based in Canberra, will visit New Zealand a couple of times a year. They always take the opportunity of coming and meeting the Speaker of the New Zealand Parliament as a courtesy. At 11:30 every day, I start then with preparation for question time. The Clerk of the House brings the questions to me, and between 11:30 and 2 o'clock, I spend my time studying those, thinking about where the answers might go, what difficulties may come up through question time, so I'm well prepared for it.
Sometimes the argument spills over into the chamber about that scrutiny process that you go into. Do you always anticipate these arguments that come up, or does something take you by surprise?
Most of them I can anticipate because the argument will have occurred first of all in lodging the question, so there'll have been a discussion between staff within the office of the clerk and various politicians or political parties about the suitability of a question. So more often than not, I'm aware that a member might be grumpy because the question that he or she submitted has been altered or required to be further authenticated.
Right.
So I tend to know what's coming up. So but I can be caught by surprise. The difficulty or the challenge I have is these points of order are raised and they must be ruled on there and then in most instances. It's a bit like refereeing without the ability to go up to a TMO when there's a close call. I've got to make a decision. Sometimes if it's an issue that's raised that I think genuinely needs further consideration, I will tell them I'll come back to the House in the next day. So it doesn't tend to happen very much. I don't look at the video at all. I go back over Hansard in the evening when it comes into my office about 5:30. I go back over the Hansard every day, and I use that as the starting point for my meeting with the clerk when he comes into my office the next day at 11:30. And we quite constructively go back over the Hansard, and I ask him, was I right in this instance? Could I have handled this a different way? And we use it as a bit of constructive criticism or constructively.
You've been Speaker now for just over 3 years. Have you settled into the job, do you think?
I think so, yes. I must admit I was very nervous when I started. It's not a job that I ever aspired to. The Prime Minister asked me whether I'd be prepared to do it. I came here with one ambition, and that was to be Minister of Agriculture, Minister of Primary Industries. I achieved that. I was thoroughly enjoying the challenge of that role. But the Prime Minister obviously thought I had the temperament and would gain the respect of the House to do the job. Having taken it on, the initial few months, I think, well, it was a nervous wreck as I took the challenge of chairing Parliament. But I've grown into it, and I'm sure that other people would say I've established a style that's me. It will be different to another speaker. It'll be different to former speakers. But I can honestly say, hand on heart, to the best of my ability, I've operated in an absolutely apolitical way. And that's the essence of being a good speaker.
No, I won't put this on, but you're the best I've seen since I was in 94.
Well, I think you should put that on. It is. You just develop a style. And I don't go to caucus. I have minimal involvement with any National Party conferences or functions. And I consider I'm privileged, I'm honoured to be Parliament's person. I'm not there to help the government. And when I asked the Prime Minister to leave that time, I was right in asking him to leave. He just defied me when I rose to my feet and told him to stop. He deserved it. My job is to give every member of Parliament a fair go, provided that member of Parliament also abides by the rules.
And those rules are in the standing orders, about to be reviewed for this Parliament by a committee chaired by the Speaker, David Carter.
That report from Tom Frewen. With the House on a four-week adjournment and no select committee meetings held over the past 2 weeks, a look back now to the Youth Parliament, which was held on Tuesday the 19th and Wednesday the 20th of July. For 2 days, 121 youth MPs were at Parliament to debate legislation, sit on select committees, ask oral questions of ministers, and also participate in a general debate.
Michael McLeod, Youth Member of Parliament for Andrew Little.
Mr. Speaker, we are the elders of the future. We are the tomorrow of the world. One of the greatest gifts that any person can receive after they have gone onward is to be remembered. Remembered by their great deeds, achievements, and of course their effort to make the world a much more happier environment to live in. My fondest wish for each and every one of you youth MPs here today is to find something in your lives worth fighting for. More specifically, I challenge you to fight for the future. However, this is no easy task. And the future of our world and our generation is something that we must treat with great care. I often refer to my peers as the leaders of tomorrow. Among our number today may be the future Prime Minister, the doctor who discovers the cure to Alzheimer's, the architect who designs one of the greatest monuments in the world, the teacher who dedicates his or her time to the betterment of young learners. We can make a difference, but when do we start? The answer to that question? We are already too late. The future and the possibility of its greatness is diminishing into a void filled with emptiness. But we can stop the eradication, the emptiness and the terror of the future. We can make change. Instead, let us build a world for the future to thrive in, free of climate change, poverty, sickness, war and terror. Let us all fight for something, Mr. Speaker. Fellow youth, be a lion and have no fear, for we serve the world. We are the elders of the future. We are the tomorrow of the world. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
I call Theresa Lee, Youth MP for Jacinda Ardern.
Mr. Speaker, New Zealand is fourth on the Global Peace Index, ninth on the Human Development Index, and in the top 10 of several human rights indices. We seem to do pretty well in the big adult world. That is if you turn a blind eye to the fact that we are 10th when it comes to income inequality on the normalised Gini Index. 30 years ago, New Zealand's wealthiest 10% were earning around 4 times as much as the average person, but now they're earning 8 times as much. The myth of the trickle-down effect has obviously not happened due to our government actively introducing policies that disproportionately benefit the wealthy, such as halving tax rates in the 1980s. But why is this disparity so pressing that even my dear friend Obama labelled it the defining challenge of our time? Real data collated by Professor Richard Wilkinson highlighted how income inequality correlates with life expectancy, homicide, imprisonment, infant mortality, teenage births, obesity, mental illness including drug addiction, bullying, even economic growth. Think of the expense as the poor live substandard lives and taxpayers have their money drained into paying for avoidable consequences. Income inequality hits hard all the way along the social hierarchy. But what truly irritates me is that you earn what you deserve myth that comes hand in hand with income inequality. The mentality that everyone is born with the same spoon in their mouth. But put yourself in the shoes of a 9-year-old girl living in a damp room with 5 other family members, walking to school in the rain with red leaky warehouse shoes. You can't remember the last time you ate breakfast. Currently, 305,000, or 30% of New Zealand children, live like this. Will they be offered the same opportunities as everyone else? Essentially, we have a system where wealth is essentially dispersed as a lottery of birth.
Dylan Pashutam, Youth MP for Dr. Palmji Palmer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Kumbaya circle from the Labor and the Greens, oddly coupled with the outdated New Zealand First, have for years now opposed something so fundamental to the growth of New Zealand, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's an odd concept that the opposition call Fortress New Zealand. We on this side of the House admit that decades ago, being a fortress delivered prosperity and growth to our country, but the world changed, and with it, so did National. Labour, the Greens and New Zealand First are the biggest opponents to free trade, opponents of wealth, opponents to the free movement of people, and opponents to the new ideas and innovations it brings. I suppose we're lucky a debate about warships hasn't come up yet, because then Winston would be frothing at the mouth. Unless, of course, they were made in China.
Order. There's a point of order.
I ask that the member stop slashing political parties and politicians as this apolitical party.
No, this is a debate. And the member will sit. The member will sit when I'm on my feet. This is a debate. And while some comments were made that you may not agree with, this is a debating chamber and members are free to express a view. I will determine the relevance of it and whether it's in order or out of order. So I'm calling Dylan Palmshootam to continue.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So let me highlight what the opposition are willing to deny New Zealanders. They are willing to deny New Zealanders access to 12 countries on the Pacific Rim, accounting for 40% of the global GDP. What an opportunity for our businesses and exporters, 508 million people freely at our doorstep. As much as the opposition want to return to Fortress New Zealand, this country did not become rich by selling to ourselves. We will not get anywhere by selling to just 4 million people, something this government has recognised.
I call Dion Maloney.
I stand here today using New Zealand Sign Language, which most of you know became an official language in 2006. Here in New Zealand. Because of this, we should be able to use our language to access education or have it interpreted into sign language so we're able to access what's said in sign language. We don't ask for much. Deaf people have a right to access education. We need to access education so we can become equal citizens with you. Kia ora, thank you.
I call Kai Winston Small, Youth MP for the Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Kia ora, Mr. Speaker. Contrary to popular belief, I am Winston's MP, but my aim is to not get thrown out today. Now, my electorate is Northland, 32% Māori, 78% Pākehā, lowest socioeconomic area. I'm going to focus on the youth today. 15 out of 17 of our secondary schools are below decile 3. Between the ages of 15 and 24, we have a population of around 7,000. Now, out of those 7,000, 2,826 are enrolled to vote. Only 52% of them voted in the last general election. Now, two questions arise when I bring those figures up. Why are only half of the youth enrolled voting? And why are so many people not enrolled? Now, Northland students are telling me that the only piece of voting education that they get is elections in New Zealand coming to their school, proceeding to guilt trip the girls into voting because New Zealand was the first country to allow white women to vote. They proceed to tell you that countries do not allow people to vote and you should feel honoured to vote. That's why you should vote. Now, I surveyed 110 Northland students. 49 of them could not tell me what their electorate was. In fact, a quote from one of the girls that I did survey told me that the electorate was the difference between the amount of votes. I surveyed a hand-picked 25 young leaders from Northland. 15 don't understand what MMP is. 21 don't understand how to vote. 15 don't know who runs Northland. 11 understand that it is more than $5 to vote in a general election. 3 believe that there is a fine if you don't enroll to vote, and another 3 understand that there is a yearly fee to vote. 1 adult aged above 21 told me that if you abstain to vote, your vote goes towards the National Party. Now, some of us may chuckle, some of us may laugh, but don't you forget that this is your generation. They represent you as much as you represent them. We need to educate them. There might be 4 rowers on each side of the waka, but if one person stops rowing, we're just going to go in a circle, aren't we?
Hannah Monogatti, Youth Member of Parliament for David Seymour.
Mr. Speaker, in the lead-up to Youth Parliament, I spent a lot of time thinking about the biggest issues facing young people today. And there was one I just couldn't go past. The one thing that, despite being guaranteed to affect every single one of us, the vast majority of politicians will not touch. On behalf of millennials and young people everywhere, I think it's time we had a conversation about superannuation. With a rapidly ageing population, the cost of super is soon expected to balloon by over $1 billion every year. In our lifetime, the number of taxpayers to each recipient is going to decrease from 5 to 2, which means by the time current university students retire, the government will be in debt by 198% of GDP. Now, for a bit of context, Greece is currently sitting on about 176. And guess what? It's our generation that are going to be forced to fund super through higher taxes, through harsh service cuts, and with no guarantee of getting the same benefits ourselves when the need arises. One thing is certain, an adjustment is inevitable, and the longer we wait, the more drastic it's going to be. So what do we do? Well, for one, policy must adapt to changing demographic trends, like longer life expectancy. One such proposal is to raise the age of eligibility from 60 to 67 or 68 over the next 2 decades, similar to what Australia is doing. This wouldn't affect current retirees or those close to retiring, and it would give those time to plan for their retirements in the future. We must be proactive on this issue, we must do something now, and we need to make sure the public has a say, rather than forcing the future generations to deal with this massive fiscal headache.
I call Cameron Wright, Youth MP for the Honourable Peter Dunn.
Mr. Speaker, what if I were to tell you of a country? Not just any country, but a country with a list of 3,540 threatened national species. A country where, up until recently, this shambles of a river was pristine natural forests and rivers. Many of the members are probably thinking smugly to themselves, what a terrible place that must be. I mean, which country would be so stupid? Luckily, this would never happen in our very own beloved New Zealand. Not true. New Zealand has systemic ecological disasters in the making. Those 3,543 national species, the government only pays to look after 200. How about those rivers? Just 38% are safe to swim in. Deforestation for farming, mining and conservation lands, overfishing, tramping huts closed, roads through the middle of national parks, dirty dairying, shark fitting, fracking. The list goes on, and it's all happening right here in New Zealand. If Pokemon Go has taught us one thing, it's that we all love to get into the environment that makes this country unique. But imagine what it would be like if our rivers were so polluted we couldn't even get near them to catch that rare water type. That is the future we are heading to, ladies and gentlemen. For the sake of the next generations, I hope we can look past our short-term financial gain and make real progress in protecting the environment. It's time for the country to move away from damaging production-based industry, such as dairy, tax tourists for the environmental damage they cause, and move towards a truly clean, green, and united future.
Honourable youth members, the time for this debate has expired. We now come to notices of motion, and my youth MP will assume the chair for this session.
I call upon Te Bari and Murera to deliver their notice of motion.
I move that this House thank Mr. Speaker, the presiding officers of Parliament, all members of Parliament for Youth Parliament 2016.
The question is that the motion be agreed to. Those of that opinion will say aye.
Aye.
To the contrary, no. The ayes have it.
I'm Rhys Lyon reporting for parliamenttoday.co.nz with funding from Parliament.